Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Useful Idiots. I am Katie Halper. Apparently, I resemble something else, which I'm going to find out shortly.
And I'm Matt Taibbi, and I'm laughing because our producer, Matt Wilson, Katie was wondering whether her lighting was appropriate, and he told her that she looked like one of the elves from Lord of the Rings movies.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
She's like backlit, like slightly, a little bit, you know, aglow.
Yeah, that's a compliment.
Yeah, kind of. Yes, yes.
The lighting part is a compliment. Like, what we have to worry about is their features and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
your face is a little CGI-ish right now.
Oh,
I would say you. No, but you look good. You
Thanks.
Look
good. Next time I get my makeup done for some appearance or something, which I haven't done in years, but I'll say, can you give me the Lord of the Rings elf look?
Right, right. Well, they do that. I would say that MSNBC is heaviest on the makeup. It's yeah. Very cakey.
So, oh, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, exactly. Is that Kate Blanchett?
Yeah.
Having established that that Katie looks like Kate Blanchett, and I don't, obviously. There's nothing about me that looks like that.
But is this you two? It's Matt and Katie.
Yeah.
That's what's his name? Hugh he's in the first Rake episode. We should know it.
Oh, he's a cannibal.
Yeah. Oh God, I can't
we
remember
gotta
his
have
name. He's a great actor.
From Rake on. Wilson, will you track down for us the character that the Rake lawyer is based on? The Rake character, the real person? We should do that, right, Matt?
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. If there's a real person. Is there a real person?
Yeah. I think it may even be named that, but yeah.
I mean, I know like 8 lawyers who are like that.
Or like that, yeah.
Yeah. But
oh God, it's such a funny show. Rake, we're talking about the Australian one, not the American one.
Yeah, the American one's a little bit subpar.
Remember he goes in and orders a coffee? One of my favorites is like when he goes in to order a coffee to a cafe and it's empty. Mm-hmm. And they're like, what's your name? He's like, a name. Like, why does that matter? Well, it's right. Me, mate. Like, I'm the only one in here, mate. And he's like, I just need your name for the coffee. And he's like, Trevor Duva Devil dude. And I can't remember. He's like, it's Dutch, mate. It's Dutch. He's like, you have a shorter version. It's like, it's Dutch. It doesn't abbreviate. And then he calls his name out, like after he makes the coffee. And then Clifford Green, the character, is like, oh, me.
Cleaver Green.
Cleaver Green, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, that's one of the recurring themes of the show is that he gets into situations, he recognizes that it's a bad idea to step over the line and get into a confrontation with somebody, but he just can't stop himself and he has to do it anyway. And next thing you know, he's in trouble.
Right.
Like he slugged somebody on the street or he's doing blow in a boxing match.
Right.
And betting all of his money on the wrong person or something like that.
He's kind of like how, like he shares something in common. It would be an interesting Venn diagram. Him, Dr. House, and Larry David on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Like those three characters all play with lines in different ways.
Interestingly, I respond to all three of those shows.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, I think the especially Cleaver's character has a lot in common with like my old decision making.
But Dr. House,
my pre-fatherhood decision making.
Pre-fatherhood, yeah. But what House and Larry David never question whether to cross the line, right? Cleaver, you see, kind of like.
Cleaver knows that every his decision making process is deeply flawed, but he just he can't help himself. That's the whole point. He's not even at peace with it. He just keeps doing it.
Right. Yeah. He has the awareness of it. That kind of, I feel like Dr. House doesn't care at all.
Yeah.
Like House is committed to it.
Yeah, you're right. I think
every now and then it has some fatal consequences.
Right. So anyway, having gotten that out of the way, happy Thanksgiving, folks. And Katie will not use that word. She'll use Indigenous Peoples Day.
Sad Indigenous Peoples Day.
Sad Indigenous Peoples Day because she's just intellectually crippled. I went to Wesleyan. Can't get past it. Can't find a way to enjoy a day that everybody else does.
What do you call me intellectually? What?
Crippled.
I thought you said verbal.
Oh no. Crippled. You're oh my that God. Too. But yeah.
Woke button. Woke double woke button. Thanksgiving.
Oh, for the. Yeah, Thanksgiving and crippled. Yeah. All right. Four food groups.
All right. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it as we banter.
Yeah. Right? This is a great. I like the banter. People like the banter, Matt.
They do?
Matt doubts our banter. What is it?
I'm a banter power. Doubter.
Yeah, you're a banter doubter.
Democrats suck. I guess I was going to go over the thing about the Democrats losing ground in the polls. Oddly enough, I'm kind of writing about this because I had to do the story about Loudoun County, and there was a big story earlier this week. Democrats have lost significantly a lot of ground in polls, especially on the education issue all around the country, which has put them at the lowest point they've been since 1981, according to Forbes, I think it is. But this is kind of a thorny issue because it dives into a whole bunch of stuff that we've talked about kind of already ad nauseum. We can probably get into with our guest our Mr. Guest. Well, we'll talk about it in a bit. Like there's a debate about even why there's a debate about this. So that makes it tough to talk about.
What we're talking about when we talk about.
Yeah. So in lieu of that, let's just go to the self-aggrandizing pat on our back, the useful idiots factor that Jen Psaki announced this week.
She announced two things. She officially announced one thing, which we're going to go over, but as we'll see, she also announced, without saying it, implicitly announced that she watches Useful Idiots, specifically our Monday morning segment.
Exactly. So if you recall on our Monday segment, if you watched it, if you didn't, you're a gigantic loser who sucks. What's a better way of putting that?
If it isn't, we invite you to make sure that you watch our Monday morning shows on YouTube, where we go over the Sunday morning shows.
No, I was going for an insult there.
Oh, you just want to be more eloquent in your insult.
Yeah.
I saw. See, you are kind of like, I feel like I'm sometimes the Cheryl to your Larry David.
Like you're trying to mitigate my horribleness?
Yeah.
I think that's sort of accurate.
Sort of accurate, right? But she's very boring. I'm like if Cheryl was a little bit more Davidian.
Right. And I'm also, my like disastrous behavior isn't unwitting. It's intentional.
Intentional, right. Which makes you more like Dr.
Villainous. Yeah.
Dr. Villainous House.
Yeah, probably. So moving on. Democrats suck this week. So Jen Psaki and Wilson, if we can see the story in the Hill. For those of you who didn't watch Useful Idiots Monday Morning Edition, we talked about the fact that there are now rumors going around Washington that if Joe Biden decides not to run for re-election in 2024, that Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris will be maybe positioning to run against one another. Therefore, there is this growing rivalry between them. And these rumors have reached the point where Buttigieg got asked about them by, I think it was Tuck Chodd, right?
It was Tuck Chodd, right?
So, of course, because Jen Psaki watches Useful Idiots, especially Monday Morning Edition, when I think she's actually usually doing a gaggle at that exact time.
To watch it and take notes.
Right. So here's the story. Biden intends to run for re-election in 2024, Psaki says. President Biden intends to run for re-election in 2024, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki confirmed Monday following a flurry of reports on discussions among Democrats about whether he would follow through on a bid for a second term. That's his intention. Okay, all right. Already, that's not good. His intention, Psaki told reporters, confirming reports that Biden has been telling advisors and staff he plans to run again. I mean, how many qualifiers can they put in there? The Washington Post reported over the weekend that Biden and his closest advisors have been reassuring allies in recent days that he plans to seek a second term. That report followed a Politico piece last week about positioning among other Democrats who may be interested in running for president should Biden decline to run for re-election. Now, again, that references a story that was in Politico, but was written by Rich Lowry of the National Review. I seriously doubt that the would be going out of its way to reassure people that a rumor is not true if it was strictly a rumor that was started by a Republican in from the National Review. This feels that this has all the earmarks of something that has been circulating a bit, and people have decided to elevate it because it's being talked about. I hate this kind of story because it's quite prevalent in Washington. They do this a lot, but now it's turned into a thing. Why is he denying this? Why does Jen Psaki feel the need to do this? And if you're gonna, if you do feel the need to do it, be unequivocal about it. Don't say he intends to run. Don't say he plans to run. Say he is running. He will run. Right?
Matt, you sound like you work for, you sound like you're writing a campaign speech for Biden.
I'm sorry. Like, this is,
no, I know, but it's the way you're saying it. He doesn't plan to run. He will run.
Right. I mean, come on. This is PR 101.
Yeah, I know.
If you want to keep the story alive, you don't like.
But what does that make you think? The fact that they are saying it that way.
First of all, it makes me think that there's real conversations that they about the possibility of him not running. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what what's going on. I think it's maladroit PR, first of all. Sometimes when these stories get out there, it's a trial balloon. In other words, it's, how does it work typically? Okay, like an aide to person X who works in the White House calls up somebody at the New York Times or the Washington Post and says, you know, why don't you call up so-and-so and ask them if they're thinking about doing an exploratory committee. I can't confirm this. I'm not going to be your source on this, but so-and-so has been talking to donors about setting up an exploratory committee for 2024. I mean, it's early for that. That story's, those stories are coming next year. But that's the way it works, right? So they put this out there, then they want to see what the reaction is when the story's out, because they're interested in seeing which way the wind blows, right? Are people excited about that? Do they get op-eds from people they don't expect saying, that's a good idea, we'd like to see that person run? Like, that's how that works. So sometimes when this thing, like the thing with the Kamala and Buttigieg thing, somebody had to work to put that out there. Like, it doesn't accidentally show up on Meet the Press.
I think, you know, my vote.
What's your vote?
Both Kamala and Pete. They snuck it in there, yeah.
You think that they're putting this out there?
Yeah, without knowing that the other one was doing it.
Yeah, it could be that. Do you think he's going to run?
Biden? No.
No, because he's going to be dead or because he's not going to run?
He's going to be probably not dead. I just think he won't be. I mean, but maybe he'd be the perfect president that way. The perfect puppet. You know what? In a way, yeah, you're right. It would be what would be the difference?
Right. I mean, he's a potted plant, basically. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't campaign.
Cactus he was talking to. Right. He did not campaign. Yeah.
He did not campaign. So he, in 2024, he won't have to campaign again. He will just be the placeholder for the party. That will probably do pretty well. That would do better than an actual talking person, probably.
Right. What you think Kamala will have to like push him, drag him?
Like
put him in a wheelbarrow or something, or
like
carriage?
On a sled.
Yeah. How would Biden get around? Let's say he couldn't move. How would he get around?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really funny if they did it like a Three Stooges episode where they tied him up and put him on like a piece of plywood and kind of dragged him everywhere, you know? Yeah.
Couldn't you imagine her doing it, like begrudgingly having to do it?
Well, what I'm imagining her doing now is increasing his chances of death at every turn. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
You know, like just sort of accidentally knocking over the poisonous substance near his cornflakes or whatever it is.
Right.
Backing up a little bit too close to the ladder in his library as he goes up to get a copy of that book that he signed once upon a time. Right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You don't think that's happening? I think that's happening.
Yeah. What do people with Munchausen by proxy, right? That's the one where they poison the people that they take care
of. But they're trying to get attention. They're not trying to kill the person.
You're right. So it's actually a fine line for them. I never realized the kind of like the work ethic that went into that Munchausen by proxy.
Yeah, no, it takes effort. Stick to it.
You can't go overboard. Well, not just that, but you have to find, it requires a lot of
knowledge. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you go too far, that attention stops. You get a lot of attention if the person dies. But
right. Well, actually, that's true. Yeah, there is a brand of Munchausen person who goes too far, but they have to have a lot of kids or something like that, so that they can go through it many times.
Oh my God, so awful.
I mean, awful beyond belief.
It's awful beyond belief. Maybe if it's an older person, that makes me feel better than a kid. I want to be clear. There's no, unlike my necrophilia positions in the past. By which
your
I stand.
Necrophilia positions?
Yeah. my posture, necrophilia posture. There's nothing redeemable. I mean, necrophilia, it's not redeemable. It's just, to me,
levels of awfulness.
But you know what I think if you're an
atheist. I know what you're thinking. Yeah.
But, and your victim's an atheist and the victim is a hermit atheist, then it's okay.
So you're saying that if you have Munchausen by proxy, that you'd rather that they did, that they made victims of an old person who's closer to the end of his or her life than a child.
Yes.
Because a child's worth of life is, of course, worth more.
Well, it's just beginning. Also, I feel like maybe cuter, probably. But also, I think, you know, more sinning has been done by an older person. They're less innocent.
Well, let's dive into your positions on this. More sinning? Wait. Oh, because the older person has already done wrong things?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So, okay. So just to combine the two things, you have Munchausen by proxy. You have accidentally killed a person that you were just trying to injure.
Yeah.
Right? At that point, is it okay to opportunistically have sex with the corpse?
No, because, this is really terrible. I mean, that brings it up to a level of posthumous incest.
Depends.
You're saying if it's not a relative? Sure.
If it's not a relative.
No, I don't think so. No, you can't, because it could be like an uncle. Uncle, that's still incest.
It's incest, but it's, you know, it's not like you're.
It's not as intense.
Kid.
Incest.
Yeah.
But you know what? No, I'm sorry. I have to put my foot down because I would be a hypocrite if I didn't put my foot down here, because just like you can't, I do not condone killing someone in order to, you know, for necrophiliac purposes. That includes Munchausen. And
Munchausen's more like felony murder.
Yeah.
You're doing something that's criminal, but it's an accidental death. You're still responsible, but.
Yeah. But I mean, it's also.
You didn't mean it.
You didn't mean it. You just meant to poison them and incapacitate them. So.
Right. But the person's dead. So it's happened. Like, you can't take it back.
I can't do that. I can't, because it's sending a bad message.
Okay.
As opposed to the look, it's one thing if there's a natural death.
Mm-hmm.
Who am I to judge? Except for I am to judge if the person is, again, we can't do it for the. And I should have said this earlier on in my necrophilia. I need to have a what's it called, like a manifesto. But you really can't do it if the person has any relatives.
All right. So that's Democrat suck. What do we have for Republican suck?
For Republican suck, we have something that a good friend of the show, Kevin McCarthy, he broke a record. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has broken the record for the longest speech on the floor of the House of Representatives after speaking for more than 8 hours.
Jesus.
He started speaking on the floor at 8:38 p.m. Thursday. And broke the record at 4:46 Friday. Mm. At 5:11 a.m., 8 hours, 33 minutes, he took to the floor. After he took the floor, he stopped talking. Do you know who broke that, whose record he broke? Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, Oh, Nancy, God, I'm looking at the headline. Jesus.
Well, you know why? Because the reason that happened is because there's a House procedure known as the Magic Minute, which allows the majority and minority leaders to speak for as long as they wish at the end of a debate on the floor. So let's watch the 8 hours. No, let's watch the Newsweek has a little condensed version of what he said.
I talk about what made me a Republican. I was in the sixth grade. I turn on the TV. I watch Jimmy Carter have a sweater on and tell me to turn the heater down, that the best days were behind us, that as an American, I had to accept less.
This is, he's like a guy at a party that stands raised too close.
I said, well, let me try to answer your question. Totally. An analogy of swimming. Picture America at a swim meet after World War II against every other country.
No, I can't think. I mean, I'm
we
sure,
jump
but I can't
into the water.
Person. You can.
Not only do we win,
there was somebody I went to college with who was sort of famous for just being like right next
so
to your
in the
face.
Next year,
you'd back up.
We think,
and
you know, that's a little unfair. The other countries
at a wall,
against the wall,
a wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got destroyed a little more than America. You're celebrating it when inflation is at a 31% height. Gas prices.
Look at the people behind him.
A border that in a few months breaks every
record. How many of those people you think are farting
right
now?
For the last 3 years combined.
At least one.
I have a friend.
Oh, yeah, look, he's adjusting his mask like some
sort of. Right before COVID, he was on Codell with other senators. And he was sitting and having a communication. Maybe you've experienced this as well. With a military general in the Chinese Communist Army. You know what that general said to him? America, you're weak. You're
probably
weak, America.
Something in Chinese, I would guess.
You're weak because you believe in God and you take fentanyl.
It's kind of a good summary of America.
I mean, yeah.
Can I be speaker? I can finish my speech up there.
And then after that, by the way, he said, personally, I didn't think I could go this long. Said the 56-year-old.
He said...
Yeah.
I mean, are you going to make the joke? I mean,
no, it's already made, right?
It's made, right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
He's a weird guy, huh?
Look, he's doing the Frank Capra thing. You know, the Mr. Smith goes
to
Washington.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it was, but that was so it's like a schlock inspirational technique that was really good in that movie.
Right.
When you're standing up for a boys club in the Midwest or whatever it was that
he did,
Jimmy Stewart
yeah.
was doing. Pretty sure it's a little less moving than when McCarthy's doing it for, what is he upset about now exactly?
Build Back Better.
Oh, the infrastructure bill. Okay.
He
his voice is
normal.
Really annoying.
Yeah, his voice is really annoying. His hand gestures are really annoying.
His voice
I can't
is,
imagine
it's like
him
nails,
being
nails
a kid
on a blackboard.
Ever.
Hmm? Yeah. You can't imagine him being a kid.
Like he shouldn't have been a kid when Jimmy Carter was president. He should have been like a full grown man.
If he was a kid when Jimmy Carter was president, he's like my age. Is that
He's 54. Oh my gosh. Wait a second.
So he was a little older than me.
He said he was in sixth grade with Jimmy Carter. He got really upset about Jimmy Carter wearing a sweater, too.
Presidents shouldn't wear sweaters?
I don't know.
Presidents usually wear shitty sweaters. Or they wear a cardigan.
Wait, when do they wear sweaters? When's the last time?
At Camp David.
Right, at Camp David. Yeah, actually, Biden wears cardigans, right, over... Trump never wore a cardigan, though.
Nixon wore cardigans.
Yeah. Trump
Nixon
never
liked,
wore one.
Nixon liked the cardigan and highball look.
I wonder what he looked like as a kid, Kevin McCarthy. I swear he came out of the womb looking that way.
With the white congressman's hair?
Yeah.
Who? What profession has the best hair?
It's a spunt.
No, that's not a spunt.
You're right. It has too many defined hairs, right?
It's too airy. A spunt is more helmety.
Right. Congealed.
Yeah.
It's one piece of hair, right?
Yeah. Who has the most classic congressman hair? See, Newt Gingrich's hair is actually too thick.
Yeah. But the cut is also atypical.
Tip O'Neill had congressman hair, right? Bright red face, alcoholic face.
Oh, he had a congressman face too, yeah.
Yeah, congressman face is like buoy red.
Right.
And then the hair is like Santa Claus white.
Right.
It's
who
good
else
hair.
Has that? Tester? No, who's the other guy?
Let's
Republican.
Let's do a quick survey. Hang on a second.
All right. McCarthy, by the way, is the first Republican in his immediate family, as his parents were members of the Democratic Party. His maternal grandfather was an Italian immigrant, and his paternal grandfather was Irish, duh, from his last name.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes him a, if you're Irish and Italian, you would be a pizza, potato pizza.
Potato pizza?
Well, you're a pizza bagel. One of my best friends is a pizza bagel. One of my best friends from childhood to today. So if you're a pizza bagel when you're Jewish and Italian and Jewish, then you are a potato pizza when you're Irish and Italian. I feel I'm allowed to say that because they're
I remember going to a comedian at the Comedy Cellar in New York when I was a kid, and there was a comedian who said, "I'm Irish and Italian, which means that I like to fight and I can."
Oh, I get it. So the implication being Irish people like to fight but can't?
Exactly.
Got it.
Anyway, so. Kevin McCarthy's an asshole.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on to, isn't that weird? As always, it's from the Fleet Street. Wilson, if we can see the UK Mirror story. 80s singer Tiffany swears at fans during awkward "I Think We're Alone Now" gig. So let's just go to the videotape. What happened?
What happened?
This is my hit.
Oh, okay. So she sang. Okay, so
I'm
basically,
right.
It goes silent when she's saying "fuck you." So.
Look out the way. Yeah.
Oh. This could almost be, isn't that terrible?
Let's just read the story. 80s teen idol Tiffany was filmed swearing at fans during an awkward performance of her hit song "I Think We're Alone Now." Tiffany, full name Tiffany Darwish, was heard singing the song roughly and also seemed to skip a few lyrics throughout. However, her fans tried to support her by singing with her. The 50-year-old was performing in Melbourne, Florida, when she got annoyed at people in the audience. She shouted "fuck you" to a few random people in the crowd. The audience reacted by cheering even more. "This is my hit," she said, according to reports. "I've been singing it right." A rep for Tiffany told TMZ that the singer lost her voice and got frustrated with her performance.
Can we just play Wilson for younger people like you, for instance? I don't know. Have you ever heard this song?
I don't know if I know it. At least I don't know her rendition.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, but to be fair, Taibbi, he may know it without, it's almost unrecognizable there. So "I Think We're Alone Now" is her cover of Tommy Haymes and the Shondell song. Her version spent 2 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot List. And we're gonna play just a teeny bit of it so people know what it actually sounds like.
What? She's playing at a mall. All right, we get it.
Oh, wait. No, keep playing. We just have to watch her dance. All right.
I mean, in an alternate universe, you know about Rick Rolling, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it could have been this video instead of the Rick Astley song, right? Like,
right. It could have been, yeah.
This is so classically 80s goofy song. So
it reminds me of when we watched Up With People.
Right, yes. It's very, very happy, up, you know, peppy song. Yeah. The version that she was singing in Melbourne, Florida, it did sound a little bit like cats fucking. It was not a happy
experience. She was off. And then that's one thing, but then she cursed at her aunt. It's one thing to sound like shit, but she does. I mean, actually, maybe what if we think of it as like a Janis Joplin style? Then it's fine.
Well, okay, all those rock stars from the 70s and 80s, and especially the punk people who didn't even bother to learn the songs half the time, but like it was really common for some of those folks to be so drunk that they couldn't remember the lines. Like that was,
but Tiffany's was like not punk. She's pop.
She's pop, yeah.
So it doesn't work. But I think if she reinvents herself as Janis Joplin, I'm not even referring to substance abuse, which obviously... Well, you know this better than me. I'm going to say substances were in the mix in that in the modern day version, in her live version.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which one.
I'm going to guess just booze. I mean.
Oh, okay, you know, just booze. Yeah, just your run-of-the-mill booze, right?
Getting up. Like that's the classic. I can't remember the lyrics to the song I've sung 5,000 times.
Right. Know? Which is sad.
50,000 times.
Which is sad because it's your claim to fame. What I don't like, so I'm willing to forgive the drinking, the bad voice, the forgetting the lyrics.
Because it's also kitsch. It's like Leslie Nielsen reinventing himself, you know, as like an ironic version of the actor that he was. Like,
right.
To get up and not look like an 80s teen idol and suck.
Own that.
It's kind of awesome in a way. Like there's a camp aspect to that.
But what we don't need is the abusive treatment of the audience, which is just being supportive. But at the same time, there's clearly a pathological codependency going on.
Yes, the audience dug it
and cheered her on. Yeah,
I think it's a net plus overall. She kind of goes off the rails.
Maybe it's not even isn't that weird? Isn't that for Matt? Maybe it's like an isn't that awesome?
It's kind of, isn't that awesome?
Yeah. I like that I like her rep's response.
Yeah, she was frustrated with her performance.
So she had to curse at the audience.
Yeah, when she finally woke up, she said that she was frustrated with her performance. Yeah. And that's why, when apprised of what she said.
Slumped in a corner.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Awakened with smelling salts.
Yeah, exactly.
Tiffany, whose real name is whatever. I think it's good.
All right. So isn't that terrible? This is isn't that terrible, but it's also, you know, we're coming up to Thanksgiving or by the time you've seen this, Thanksgiving will have passed. But it's an important time because you're probably going to be eating leftovers anyway. This is a cautionary tale and we got a terrible video, but it's also, there's a silver lining, which is that a doctor is going to give you some advice about how to not have painful things come out of your penis. So,
go ahead.
Yep. Jagged crystal urinated out of man's penis leaves internet wincing in pain. And this is from the Mirror. Is it Daily Mail or the Mirror?
Daily Star.
Daily Star. Wow. Okay. All right. So let's just watch this. And we know this because there was a TikTok video of it. So let's just play this. And it's just so people can see. Let's play. First play the video, then I'll describe what it
is. Your boyfriend just peed this out. I never knew kidney stones could be so evil.
All right. My poor boyfriend just peed this out. Poor urethra. I never knew kidney stones could be so evil. Look at that sharp little razor tip.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
Now, let's hear what the doctor has to say.
10% of people will get kidney stones at some point in their lives. Lucky you. 10%. Make these three changes to your diet so you're not in that 10%. Strangely enough, low calcium can actually cause kidney stones. You need to get enough calcium in your diet so it can bind to oxalate in the stomach and intestines before it moves to the kidneys. Eating foods with calcium is a good way for oxalates to leave the body and not form stones. Don't go overboard with salt. Excessive salt in the diet can keep calcium being absorbed, leading to kidney stones. And don't go crazy with animal protein. Animal proteins contain purines. Eating too much can cause uric acid to build up in your urine, increasing the risk of
Matt, do you do any of those things? You probably do the...
I do all of those things. I'm going to see the ear cyst explode.
Oh, yeah. Let's watch the ear cyst explode. Should we?
Yes.
Okay. Warning. The following footage contains graphic content. Viewers may find distressing. So for people just watching, not listening, it's a woman with a cyst in her ear. She's squeezing it. Let's see. It's going to come. Let's see what happens. Is that a cyst? Or is it... What is it
saying? It's a zest. Ah! Ew.
Ew.
Oh,
so she
God.
She squeezes out pus. You know, there is a woman named Dr. Pimple Popper. Have you heard about this woman?
No, that sounds horrible, though.
Well, she's like a viral sensation. She has a show.
Oh, here's it. Next up, Dr. Pimple Popper bursts. Let's.
Custard.
Ooh, God. Ew.
We should have a trigger warning on this. But, you know... All right, let's see. Let's see the
custard chest cyst.
Oh, wow.
Oh, and I'm going to have to watch this so many more times when I edit this.
That's great. All right, so we see a cyst on someone's chest. I think she's about to squeeze it. She's got a scissor and a tweezer. Now, before doing this, she does numb them up. So you're just grossed out by that. Is that correct? You don't find any part of it satisfying?
Oh, man.
I have a theory about why people find these things satisfying.
It just reminds me of a Boston cream donut.
Oh, well, that must make you feel conflicted because you don't want to eat that, right? For all I know, you're disgusted by Boston cream donuts, but I don't think that's the case. I'm guessing you, every other normal person, enjoys
them. Yeah, I love them. Amazing. Yeah. No, what's your theory?
That it's like an evolutionary thing. Like we're programmed to groom.
Right. Yes.
And so there's something that people
something
like.
Something that's satisfying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's a fine line between disgusting and awesome. Satisfying. But let's keep plumbing that line.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. All right. So we have a great guest we're going to talk to today.
Yeah. So Adolf Reed, who is the author of many books, including a new book that's coming out. We're going to talk to him about that. He's also the editor of Nonsite, which is a great peer-reviewed website, online journal. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Jim Crow and Its Afterlives. And he is launching a podcast called Class Matters. So let's talk to Adolf Reed, repeat offender, repeat guest of the show.
Afford Anything talks about how to avoid common pitfalls, how to refine your mental models, and how to think about... how to think.
Paula, while certainly you can mess up on $1 million a year, it is far less likely than it is on $30,000 a year.
Right.
I would meet wonderful people that were struggling with a budget that was super tight. It was 100%. You need to make more money.
Make smarter choices and build a better life.
Afford Anything, wherever you listen.
What's going to happen in the country? Like I've been saying for a while, we're not that far away from losing even the shards of nominal, democratic institutions in the country. So
what would you say to the first thing to go will be what's the scenario that you fear the most?
Well, one of them was, out and out coup against Biden. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's less likely to happen at the moment. I think somewhere between, loss of one or both houses of Congress, next year, more propagation of this kind of insane politics. And it's not just the US, right? I mean, we can see internationally now how the right has been able to blend the sort of upscale, superannuated hippie or yuppie, anti-vax politics with the survivalism. And those people have been hanging out together, Rob, as you know, for a while anyway. But with the back to nature hippies, have been to me anyway, increasingly difficult to distinguish from right wing survivalists. And now, you know, COVID hysteria, you know, is doing the same, has kicked it all up into a higher gear. I mean, I was telling my son this morning, like a couple months ago, I think, when, you know, whatever it was at Arkansas, sort of leapt to the top of both the coaches and the writers' polls for the Delta variant, right? Mm-hmm. CNN sent Senator Ernest Young, the reporter, to Arkansas. She was interviewing people. And, you know, that, you know, there was an array, but the one that most struck me was a guy, looked like he's like early 30s or something, maybe, you know, didn't seem like a wacko, seemed like an ordinary guy. And he tells the reporter, you know, that they aren't getting the vaccine, right, because, you know, they don't get vaccinated in his family. So she asked him earnestly, so what, did you get a religious dispensation to keep, you know, so the kids could avoid the school vaccines? And the guy says there in the same breath, he says, oh, no, we get the ones we have to. Right. So it's clear there's ideology working here. And mm-hmm. the right has been very good at reading the tea leaves and taking advantage of people's understandable anxieties and insecurities in a way that the liberals, you know, can't quite do. And so now I know. So like the liberal response is to try to shame people into doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to make fun of what's a Bill Maher world, right?
Right.
But and yes, it's true that doesn't work. But then at the same time, right? There is a public health crisis, and the state has coercive authority, and it just seems like this is an appropriate occasion to impose coercive authority. But the catch 22. Is that neo-fascist right or crypto or dayglo fascist or whatever, right, has been so adept at mobilizing what seems to be like a libertarian, don't tread on me kind of sensibility to oppose any assertion of government authority. So where does that leave us, right? I mean, right there, not serious, right, but the government authority that they're opposed to is the government that the liberals are running. So we're in a tough spot. And you know, I don't see between Manchin and Sinema, right, on the one side, who seem to be, and I've also begun to wonder about the extent to which, you know, Biden, Pelosi, and Schumer have been part of the game from right. the very beginning, at least in a sense. That they've always known. I don't know about Biden, but I know that Schumer and Pelosi have known since at least the summer what you know, the monkey wrenches that Manchin and Sinema have been planning, you know, to toss into the process to keep anything seriously redistributive from happening. And the question is whether Pelosi and Schumer and the people around Biden just hope that they played it out, you know, all the way, that something would change, or if they just thought, or if they were just trying to diddle us Biden all the way along.
Don't you think it's the latter? I mean that's the pattern of the party for ages, isn't it?
Oh well, no, totally. Yeah, I mean, like, you'd like to think that they learned something. You know, from January 6th, that they learned something from Brian Deese and BlackRock. And it's kind of funny now that asset managers are like the left wing of the Democratic Party at this point, and certainly the left wing of the Biden administration. And things come to a funny pass when that's what you got to put your hope in. But you know what? That's what you got to put your hope in. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't have any difficulty believing that this has been the same old bullshit over and over again. Because that's basically what they told us in 2020, right? That Sanders wasn't electable because he believed in something, right? Right, because he stood for something. And the way that they mobilized, right, the entire apparatus, and I know people have gotten in my case for saying this, but it just seemed to me to show that they were more frightened of the left than they were of Trump. And what people would say to me is, well, but they really believed. I said, well, yeah, they really believe it. But they really believe that Bernie wasn't electable, because that's what they need to believe.
Right,
for the commitments that they all made, right? So it doesn't matter whether they're sincere or not. I mean, because it all comes out in the same place. And that's what I would say to the question that I've been puzzling over in my head too, but you know, like, to what extent had they been diddling us all along, or to what extent had they been hopeful, you know, for something? The answer doesn't really matter, because we get to the same place in the same way.
So is obviously there were polls last week. There were a couple of stories in Forbes. We saw, I think, in the last couple of days that right now Democrats are at the lowest point they've been at since 1981, you know, at this stage of the process. Do you attribute it at all to their failure to do something? You categorize it as redistributive, or to address actually sort of real economic concerns in the population. What's the primary driver for you?
I'll say a couple of things. The first thing is that I'm not really that concerned about where they are now, because that can all change in a week. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's not so much the issue. One thing that did not make sense to me through this process, although I guess I could understand it, right? But from the beginning, right, I mean, they were pushing how much money they were going to spend, not what they were going to spend it on. And I think that that's partly something as naive, which my dad put him incorrectly, but would always say it was just French for stupid, about their approach to this, because their reflex, right, is to try to win the editorial board of the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Right? So you win the editorial board of the New York Times by saying, hey, we're proposing the biggest social spending package since FDR. And that's what you hype, right? It's like, all right, but you keep doing that over and over again, but don't really talk about what the components are. So that didn't help, certainly. And especially once they, you know, cut the $3.5 trillion to $1.75 trillion or to whatever it is now. And we'll see just how little actually comes out of the Senate vote, or comes out after the Senate vote. So I think that's one problem. And I think one of the reasons for that problem is, well, a couple of reasons, is on one level, it's a dependence on political consultants and that inside the Beltway, you know, discourse. And they depend on political consultants because they've found political consultants to be, or they found the services and the game that political consultants sell to be appealing, because, as the consultants point out, like, this is a better, more efficient, cheaper, less potentially disruptive alternative to mobilizing a base, right?
Right.
This has been the case. And almost like the Whigs in the 1840s and 1850s, like, they don't want to.
That's a scary comparison. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I know. Well, and look, I mean, there used to be a time, not all that long ago, when I kind of hoped for the moment of the Whig meltdown, thinking something good would come out of it. Now, but the other side is so prepared. The Whig, meltdown will be the end of us, or would be the end of us, basically. But I think that they're torn, right? I mean, they're torn. They've got a Wall Street constituency, and they've got the rest of us. And unlike the Republicans, who've been able to, and like, this isn't so much because the Republicans are clever, it might be just the opposite. But like, they've been able to put together a winning electoral coalition that submerges the material contradictions in their base, right? So like, going back to Reagan, right? I mean, the anomaly seemed to be that cokehead Silicon Valley hedge fund operators, right, would vote for full voting rights for every zygote and like all the rest of the stuff, right, that the social conservatives wanted, stuff that they couldn't give unless it was shit about. And then, by contrast, or on the other side of the coin, 1996, when Pat Buchanan was about to make his move, right, to bust into prime time, Falwell and Pat Robertson and the Holy Roller Right, which were the cornerstone to his base, bailed on him. And they, at their, you know, summer jamboree or whatever, determined that what Jesus wanted most of all was cutting capital gains taxes and combating inflation. And like, this is how cult or how a political alliance actually works, right? It's that I vote for what you want, right? Even if I don't give a shit about it for me personally, because I understand fundamentally that fighting for what you want is a necessary condition for being able to get what I want. That's what the Democrats don't really have. One reason they don't have it is that, for historical reasons, a big chunk of the electoral base of the Democratic Party are people who are concerned with material questions, you know, from the standpoint of the working class, basically. Right? Mm-hmm. The DLC was founded, since the Democratic Leadership Council was founded in 1985, but like they've been telling the rest of us, don't worry, we'll take care of you, but we've got to take care of Wall Street first, and then we'll come back for you. Well, it's just run out, basically. So I think that we are, I've been describing it of late as like a T intersection, partly because I walk past one on my daily walk. But we're at a point where, you know, the neoliberal consensus is no longer able to you know, deliver enough to enough of a share of the population to maintain its stability as a democratic or as a nominally democratic order. So only two ways to go, right, at that T intersection. One is a sharp turn toward authoritarianism, and the other is a turn in the direction of, you know, something that shares a sensibility with the social democratic politics, right, or at a minimum, a politics that's anchored on concrete expressions of what a government and the public good would look like. This is the time for me to make my first plug for our podcast. Actually, I might make more,
yes,
more than one, but the Debs Jones Douglas.
You're allowed four, I think. The SEC.
Oh, good. Excellent. Yeah. All right. Excellent. Yeah. Well, the Debs Jones Douglas Institute is kicking off, and I know this is the first place that I announced it was coming, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is probably within a week or so going to kick off our podcast called Class Matters. Mm-hmm. And the tag question is, you know, what would the, you know, this is the place we discuss what the country would look like if we're governed by and for the working class. And our first official episode, we just taped it Monday. It's going to be cleaned up and out probably next week. But this is the other direction, right? Like, we need to have a politics that starts out from that, and not some, you know, abstract shit like they talk about on the West Wing, like government and public good, but concrete instantiation. So stuff like postal banking, right?
Right.
Right.
That's a big Bernie idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Access to healthcare, education, housing, without crazy constraint by ability to pay, right? Right. Access to social goods as a right, basically. And wages, jobs, right, that stuff, the stuff that people are actually concerned about when they get up in the morning and when they go to bed at night. And I know, like, so this is like one little intervention that's like trying to drain the ocean with a teacup and a leaky teacup and a leaky Demetask cup, even. But like, we've got to try to start to build an alternative basis for politics. And I'll say one more thing about the current moment, you guys may know, I've never been like a huge enthusiast for, you know, the idea of, you know, building a movement through through electing people. But that said, I will say, and there's a big exception for Bernie, we can talk about that, maybe not, there's no need. But watching the last couple of months, like, I've been really impressed with the Congressional Progressive Caucus, right? The House Caucus. They're savvy. They know how to bargain. I think people like Jayapal and Khanna were directly, responsible for turning around the narrative, at least on CNN, where like the default was to say, well, you know, when are these progressives going to realize that they got to compromise? And they were successful in like getting across to those people that, look, it's not a matter of passing something to say you passed something, because, you know, once again, you know, we're not trying to win the editorial board of the New York Times. But whatever gets passed has to connect with the real concerns of actual people out there, and they have to be able to see what gets passed as something that makes their lives better. That was great. And they worked the insider outsider thing, or they worked the insider thing, right, as well as it could be worked. But then we get to a point where it's clear that the condensation of large corporate interests within the Democratic Party, right, in Congress, it was set to block anything, right? And that's the moment when a body like the Progressive Caucus should have been able to appeal to their constituents from out in the country, prosaic. So I just think about 500,000 people on the 14th Street Bridge in DC. But they don't have the capacity to do it because it's not that kind of base, because they're an electoral movement, with an electoral base. And mm-hmm. they don't have the kind of thick connections to a grassroots base out there that can be mobilized on a national basis, which is another way to get to this point, that we've got to have both, right? We can't just have, there are no shortcuts to building the kind of popular movement that we need and have to have, can't do without, right? But to shift the terms of debate. And I know, people think, well, but we don't have time, right? The fascists are at the gate, and guess what? This time they actually are, right? But there is a wolf at the door. But my response is always, well, one of the reasons the wolf is at the door now is that we haven't been doing this kind of deep organizing for 40 years. So there hasn't been a basis to push back. So you got to be able to do both things at the same time. And I hope that, we'll be in a position where we aren't trying, to form like little, guerrilla bands in the wilds of New Hampshire. Right? But that's kind of where I think things are at this point.
Sure.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. That was great, as usual.
It was great. The Rittenhouse case is uncomfortable to talk about for me. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I mean, I love it. I love Adolf Reed. He's like maybe my favorite guest that we've had. I think he's like funny. And
yeah, very funny.
Very charming, thoughtful.
Smart.
Thinks for himself. Not predictable.
Right. Well, guys, by the time you've seen this, you will have had your Thanksgiving. So hopefully you had a good one. And
Have a good holiday, everybody.
Yeah, you too. All right.
See you next week.
Hello. Thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
The Bigger Pockets portfolio of podcasts are worthy of your investment.
We're having a real conversation as real estate investors.
New episodes available every day.
It's important to buy where it makes money and not necessarily where you want to travel to.
Bigger Pockets, On the Market, Rookie Real Estate, or Money Podcast.
The purpose of flipping is to create more cash so then you can reinvest into other types of properties.
The Bigger Pockets podcast on YouTube or wherever you listen.